All right, so you know who I am, Patty McGlinchey, and today's class, first one is on the brain, and the second one on the spinal cord. So this is just amazing stuff. I wish I had, I don't know, like 7 weeks to teach it to you, so I could really give you all the good information out there. I'm just going to have to rely on you to be proactive and look for it yourself once you have the free time. So you have all your objectives and your learning steps. The class is outlined that way, so it follows those. As I said before, and I know it's been a couple classes since I said it, everything in this class is testable. I will tell you if something is not testable, but I want you to know it all or I wouldn't be teaching it. Okay, so what we're going to do first, let me get through all these objectives. We are going to look just generally at the brain, and then we're going to start out looking at some of the support parts of the brain, and then finally get into the actual neurotissue. So, first of all, the brain is made of or composed of four principal parts, and then its support system. Principal parts are listed up here. You have the brain stem, and this model, which you may not have recognized, is actually a lot of the brain stem. The things on the top here, the egg-looking structures, are not part of the brain stem, but pretty much everything that my hand's not covering, down to about here, is brain stem. And that can be broken into the medulla oblongata, the pons, and the midbrain. And we'll go through each of those later on and talk about what exactly they do. So that's one principal part. The other one is the cerebellum. That's the part in the back of the brain. So just holding up one hemisphere of the brain, the cerebellum is the pale yellow back here. Then you have the diencephalon, which is probably the trickiest name of the bunch. The diencephalon is the part of the brain I did my research on back in college. That consists of the hypothalamus and the thalamus. Very, very interesting parts of the brain. Of course, I'm biased. So that part, the diencephalon, is actually the two egg-looking structures, and then the part kind of right below it. So everything above my hand would be your diencephalon, deep inside the brain. If you look at it this way, and like it is on the slide, the diencephalon is the head here of the hummingbird. Use your imagination. Okay, head of the hummingbird. And the beak area, that would be your diencephalon. And the last part is the cerebrum, and that's the part everyone thinks of as the brain. Okay, and that's the part with all the convolutions. We said yesterday the name of those are the gyrus and the grooves, which we'll get into naming all that and all the different parts. So those are your four principal parts. We'll get into much detail as we go through. And then you have the support system. And the support system consists of meninges, cerebral spinal fluid, and the blood that supply the brain. And that's where we're going to start first. We're going to look at support first and then actually get into the neurotissue. So support-wise, I'm going to present it as looking at the coverings of the brain. What actually protects and covers your brain? Because, you know, your brain is very vital. Very vital. You want it to be protected. And you were created in such a way that it really is highly protective. So first thing you have protecting the brain is the skull. In particular, or specifically, the cranium. You got 8 bones which fuse together to provide a very strong, supportive outer shell covering that brain. Has anyone ever fractured their cranium? It's hard to do. Do you want to share with us what you did? Were you jumped?
2 or 3 jumping out of a plane.
Oh. Ouch. Ouch. If you didn't hear him, did you hear everyone here? You did? Ran into a tree jumping out of a plane. Was it a training jump? Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. I have to tell you guys just a little. I'm actually airborne qualified. I know it's going to shock you, but so I did all 5, and that's about all they let me do. And I loved all 5 of them. Well, you know, physical therapists, they really don't have airborne physical therapists in the military. But I got to do that before I became a physical therapist. Okay, so we have these 8 bones fusing together. When you're born, they are not fused. You probably know this. You have some fibrous connective tissue that is connecting these unfused bones, but they're not actually fused yet. It takes some growth for those bones to get to the point where they fuse together. Now, in that infancy stage, that fibrous connective tissue where you don't have bones, you just have that, is called your fontanelles. Does that name ring a bell? Yeah, you've heard that before. Now, don't look at your handout. It's not on the slide. When those bones do fuse, what kind of joint do they make? Sutures, which is classified as? Fibrous. Hey, I love it. What kind of motion do you have?
None.
Yeah, none at all. All right, and you all know you don't want to put your finger and press down on a fontanelle, right? That's not a really good thing to do because that's just a fibrous connective tissue covering, and beneath that is your brain. So putting pressure on little baby's fontanelles is not a very nice thing to do to the poor mature baby. And then you can also sometimes see the actual pulsing of the blood as it goes through the brain. If you have a newborn young baby before they're fused, if their blood pressure gets up, they're screaming, yelling, having a little fit, you can actually see the pulsations through that fontanelle. It's very interesting. If it's dehydrated, if it's sunken in, So it's you know, it can be used functionally, clinically, but you don't want to mess with them. Now, so we have bones. Very hard, very protective covering. Takes something very traumatic to fracture the cranium. Going deep, the next thing we have protecting the brain are the meninges. These are three coverings that are between the cranium and the actual neurotissue. So going from deepest to outermost, I like to do it that way, you have the pia mater, the arachnoid, and the dura mater. The reason I like to go that way is if you do it that way, they spell pad, P-A-D. It's a pad between the bones and the brain. Pia mater, arachnoid, and dura mater. Let me get a little bit more specific on my slide here. The pia mater. If you look at the translation of those words, pia actually stands for delicate, and mater, it's one T, not matter, it's matter. Matter, I can't actually say it with one T. But that is mother. So this is your delicate mother. Okay, that's what I am, so sweet, delicate, when I'm at home with my dear 14-year-old who does his silly science experiments during class. Anyway, the pia mater, the delicate one, lies directly on the neurotissue. In fact, you cannot pull it off the neurotissue when you dissect. So when I bring down the actual cadaver brains, what you're looking at is not neurotissue. You're looking at pia mater. Underneath that is the neurotissue. Very thin, very delicate, directly on the neurotissue. The next one out. And on this slide up here, it's in green. I dare use this pen. Okay, let's see if I can get it. Whoops, wrong thing. So I'm going to do it in red now, but that would be your pia mater. Very delicate, very thin. The next one out is your arachnoid. Arachnoid, just by the name of it, you should be thinking spidery. And this has a web-like appearance. It actually has a thick membrane, not super thick, but thick membrane, and then it has a webbing that comes down. I probably should use another color. You know, the pen's actually working right today. Okay, so the arachnoid, you have one thick covering and then a webbing that extends down and touches the pia mater. So it actually communicates with it touching, but it's a webbing coming down. So between the webbings, there's a space. And that space is filled with fluid. What do you think the fluid's called? Cerebrospinal fluid. So that's where your fluid lies. Between the arachnoid and the pia mater, within the webbing of that arachnoid. Going one more layer out, you have the dura mater. Translates to tough mother. And that's what my 14-year-old hopefully thinks I am. That child of mine. Now the tough one, the dura mater, is very, very strong. And I'm going to bring down a real cranium. And inside, you're going to see the dry dura mater. You'll actually see it's very tough, very, very strong, and that lies on the outermost. So going on this, it's right on the other side of the arachnoid there, and they actually, the arachnoid and the door lie right on top of each other. So pia mater, arachnoid, dura mater. Clinically, you may have heard of meningitis. It's an inflammation of the meninges. Typically, it's the arachnoid and pia mater layers that get inflamed. It can be viral, bacterial, and even fungal, but it's most likely viral or bacterial. If it's bacterial, that's pretty serious. And we'll talk more about that at the end of the course, so stick around for about 4 more months, and you'll have a class on that. Now, meninges are continuous with those meninges that surround the spinal cord. So you have them around the brain, and they continue to go around the spinal cord. So when I get to that class in a couple hours, I'm going to talk about the meninges. It's the same exact thing. They are continuous down into the spinal cord area. All right, and that's the clinical thing there. Okay, so the next support thing is the cerebrospinal fluid. It actually lies within the meninges, as I said. Which two layers does it lie between? The arachnoid and the pia mater within the webbing. Great. This fluid is a nourishing fluid. It removes waste as well as nourishes, and it also protects. Okay? You know, you have a good cushion in there with that fluid. It absorbs some of the pressure as you jiggle your brain around. That helps keep it from banging into the skull. Okay? So it has a protective part too. The protective is not just structural. There's also a chemical protectiveness about it because of removing the waste and other harmful agents. It flows within that space between the arachnoid and the pia, and it too is continuous down into the spinal cord region, flowing between the same two layers of the meninges down around the spinal cord. It starts out in the spaces within the brain. So just looking at this hemisphere of the brain, this half, you'll see right here there's kind of like a hole. That's one of the ventricles, one of the spaces of the brain. The cerebral spinal fluid starts there. It actually is made there by the choroid plexus. And let me turn the slide here. Choroid plexuses, which are just like a bundle of capillaries. Anytime you hear plexus, think of a weaving or a bundling or a braiding. So a choroid plexus is a braiding, a weaving, a bundle of capillaries that lie within that ventricle. They secrete the fluid, the cerebral spinal fluid. It's continuously made. It circulates from one ventricle to the next, and there's four. We're going to name them soon. Goes all the way down and around the spinal cord, comes back up, and gets reabsorbed into the blood system, into a vein. It's constantly flowing. Don't think of the cerebral spinal fluid as being something stagnant. Constantly being formed, constantly being reuptaked. Reuptaked or uptaked? Let's put it that way. It contains glucose, proteins, minerals, and other substances. It's a lot like plasma, which makes sense because it's being formed from the vascular system, from those capillaries secreting it. Clinically, you can have a problem with cerebral spinal fluid, and that is hydrocephalus. Now let's look at this picture here, and you have the same one in your handout. This picture has arrows in it that shows the flow of the cerebral spinal fluid. So if you start out in the very center of the picture, I'll put an arrow here, blue, let's make it red. Okay? Where the arrow is in there is that's your ventricle, your space. You see the blood vessels kind of bundled up in there? That would be your choroid plexus. Capillaries, bundled up, knotted up, a whole bunch of them. The black arrows show how they secrete cerebral spinal fluid. That's where it starts. That's where it comes out. Look farther down in the picture, and you'll see another bundle of capillaries down here. That's another ventricle, another choroid plexus. It secretes cerebral spinal fluid as well, so you see little black arrows coming out. The cerebral spinal fluid flows, and if you follow the white arrows, you'll see how it flows around the brain and around the spinal cord. And then go to the very top of the picture, above the cerebrum, and you'll see some white arrows. I'm going to draw red on top of it, that are going up into some little granulations, just little pockets. The cerebral spinal fluid flows up there. Because more is being formed all the time, there's a pressure building up. So the pressure builds up in these granules, and then the cerebral spinal fluid is taken back up into those veins. That's why they're colored blue, their veins. And the fluid goes back into the vascular system, along with the waste it picked up. So it cleans out the area, and new fluid is formed. So what happens if we get a block? Ouch. We're still going to make cerebral spinal fluid, right? So the choroid plexus is still going to be pouring out cerebral spinal fluid, but if there's a block anywhere along here, you're going to have a buildup of that fluid and a buildup of pressure. Now, depending on where the block is, depends on where the main parts of the injuries occur, but essentially, you have a system that's supposed to keep creating and keep letting go of the fluid. If there's a block, you're going to have hydrocephalus, which means a buildup of pressure. Now, if it's a newborn, which this does happen not often, but it does happen in infants, their cranium's not fused. So the bones of their cranium are going to separate. The head will enlarge. And you've probably seen pictures of that. I have one as well, I think. Let me see if it's the next picture. Yeah, there we go. With an enlarged cranium due to hydrocephalus. If it's an adult, you're not going to get that. The bones are fused. So it's going to put pressure on the brain to the point where there is brain damage if the pressure's not relieved. It will also put pressure on the brain. And if you think of the skull, the bottom of the skull, you have a hull. Oh, gosh, someone put quarters in there. And that hull down at the bottom of the skull is your foramen magnum. And if there's a lot of pressure building up in the brain, that is the only hole coming out of the cranium. It's going to push the neurotissue of the brain out that hole. Is the brain going to fit out that hole? No way. So what happens is the very base of the brain, which is your brainstem, will get pressure put on it. And as you will learn, that's an area of the brain you don't want pressure put on it. It will kill you. So that's one of the dangers of hydrocephalus, not just brain damage, but it will result in death if that part of the brain gets pressure. So how do they relieve this? They put a shunt in. Emergency shunt, they get it in there, drain out the extra cerebral spinal fluid, try to unblock the block, and go from there. Some people have conditions where they can't just unblock the block. And in that case, they'll put a shunt in, hook up a tube, which empties out into the abdomen. And there's a picture of that in your handout. So there are some clinical ways to relieve this as long as it gets treated. That's the big thing. So that is hydrocephalus. Yeah, I'll go by that quick. All right, so continuing on, we're still looking at kind of the support, the backup parts of the brain. Let me name the ventricles. I already talked about them. These are the spaces in your brain. There's four of them. They're named pretty much logically. You have two lateral ventricles, and then you have a third ventricle and a fourth ventricle. So going from top superior to inferior, you have your two lateral ventricles, one in each hemisphere of the brain. And then centrally, you have your third and then your fourth ventricle. They work their way down. Two laterals, a third and a fourth. Looking at the picture on the slide that you have in your handout as well, the two lateral ones, they kind of make a bit of a C shape. It's like a fancy C shape like that. So I just scribbled all over one of the lateral ones. The other lateral one is behind it. It's shadowed because they lie right next to each other, and in this view, you can't see the two of them. And then, midline, you have your third. It's right here. It looks like it has an eyeball. That's actually neurotissue running in between it. And then the fourth one is down lower. Two lateral, a third, and a fourth. What is contained in those ventricles? Cerebral spinal fluid. What makes the cerebral spinal fluid? Choroid plexus. Say that. The choroid plexus? It lies in the ventricles. Wonderful. All right, continuing on with support. We have circulation going to the brain. Very important. You need blood going to the brain to feed the brain, to give it oxygen and any other nutrients it needs to survive. There are four main arteries feeding the brain. And they come in pairs. So you have two vertebral arteries. Can you guess how they enter the brain? Up the vertebrae. Okay, and you'll see the cervical vertebrae have little holes in their the processes that come out to the sides, the transverse processes. That's where the vertebral artery lies. And then you have two internal carotid arteries that come in more anteriorly. The four main arteries do something quite miraculous. They join together like a circle of friends holding hands. And in doing so, they make it so that if one of those four gets shut down by a blood clot in an internal carotid artery, the other three can actually provide the blood to the brain. So you won't have brain damage if you just have one blocked up. And you'll see this. You'll see patients that have internal carotid arteries that are 90% blocked. You're like, oh my gosh, how are they surviving? Because the arteries come together. That coming together is called the circle of Willis. It's one of those marvels in anatomy, the circle of Willis. Now you have this picture. This shows you the vertebral arteries and the internal carotid artery. So vertebral arteries, you got to look in the neck. You'll see the vertebrae, and you'll see an artery running up the side of the vertebrae and running through the holes in the transverse processes. That's your vertebral artery. You have two of them. They enter the brain posteriorly. Then you have the internal carotid artery. You go to the common carotid, which breaks into the internal and external. External goes to the face. Internal goes internally. So that's your, you can see that if you search on the picture, you'll find the internal carotid artery going in there. I won't have you try to identify these arteries on a picture. I just want you to know what they are, but not find them in a diagram. You also have a picture of the circle of Willis, where they come together. Now, the way I describe it, you know, holding hands, they all come together. It makes it sound like they all hold hands and come together. They don't actually do it that way. If you look here, now what you're looking at is the underside of the brain. So you take the brain and you're holding it this way. So you're looking from down below. Towards the bottom of the screen is your cerebellum, the posterior part of the underside of the brain. Coming up that, you have two main arteries that come up and then come together and form one main artery. Those are your two vertebral arteries coming in. So you see how they join together early and form one artery. So if one vertebral artery is blocked, the other vertebral artery can supply the blood that both of them were supposed to supply. So that's one way they come together. If you follow that main artery up, you'll see two little twigs of arteries. These are little fellas that come off it and go to the internal carotid artery. They join together. Now, you're going to have to look on your diagram to figure out what's what. Internal carotid artery is labeled IC. On my picture, I'm going to put IC in blue, and right here is your internal carotid. Here would be your other one. This is your vertebral artery coming up. Vertebral artery coming up makes an upside-down V, makes one artery, and then you have the little twigs of the arteries on either side coming off, joining with the internal carotid. And then the two internal carotids loop around and join together anteriorly. And together, that is your circle of Willis. I will agree with you that it does not look so much like a circle as a stick drawing without arms. That's your circle of Willis. So it's just an amazing marvel, which allows a lot of people to survive that would otherwise be dead because of a blocked artery. That's your arterial part of your blood supply. The venous part, oh, I forgot I have words in here. The venous part, meaning the part that takes the blood away, you have the two main veins, the internal jugular. They're pairs, so you have a left and a right internal jugular. And then within the veins, you have something called sinuses. Within the veins, within the brain, I mean. Within the brain, the veins are called sinuses. The reason you change the name is because they don't have the structure of a normal vein, a tube-like structure. In this case, they're flatter and wider. That's why they have the name sinuses, but they are vein in function. They do the exact same thing. And you have this picture in your handout. I'm sorry it's black and white, but you can just color it all blue if you want to get it the typical vein color. And these show your sinuses and how the sinuses all join here at the bottom of the picture to become the internal jugular vein. So it's just wider, flatter veins up in here. I know they still look like tubes, but in real life they are wider and flatter. They collect the blood, take it back to the heart to get oxygenated. What else do they collect besides blood? Yeah, I'm hearing it. Cerebral spinal fluid. Remember, up here at the superior sagittal sinus, you don't need to know that name, you have some granulation, some pockets where the cerebral spinal fluid pressure builds up and pushes it back into the vascular system. So it's not just collecting the blood to leave the brain, it also pulls in the cerebral spinal fluid to leave the brain. All right. So clinically, what can I say about blood flow? Well, if you don't have it, your brain will die. Your brain will die. Perhaps you won't die, but your brain will die. Now, it will die just in the area that it doesn't have blood. And also, I don't know if you know this, but blood is actually toxic to cells. So if you have a bleed in the brain, even if a cell is getting its own blood supply from somewhere else, just being in contact with blood, that kills off the brain cells too. So the disorder that is the blood disorder of the brain is the cerebral vascular accident. It's a biggie. It's probably the number one neuro patient you're going to see out there. So it's CVA, or commonly known as a stroke. And that can happen in two different ways. Either there's a clot, which stops the blood from flowing to the tissue of the brain, or there's a leak or a break in a blood vessel, which stops the blood from flowing any further and also allows blood to get into the neurotissue and kill it that way. So CVA, number one brain injury, very, very common. Now, it talks about some of the disorders that occur with the CVA. Look at that picture. That's a biggie. Okay? That's a big CVA. And the disorders under there, the first one is one you may not have heard of yet, but by the end of this morning you'll be familiar with it. That's aphasia. Anytime a disorder, or anytime anything starts with an A, it means a lack of. So aphasia, we're talking about something's lost. And in this case, what's lost is the ability to communicate. Folks that have CVAs very commonly have an aphasia, meaning they have a communication problem. And we'll talk more about that as the class goes through. You'll see them having motor loss, meaning they can't move their muscles the way they should have. Oops, let me go back. And you'll see them having sensation loss, personality changes, and a whole bunch of other things. Again, stay tuned till the end of the course, and we'll have a whole class on CVAs. But now, are you ready to get into the neurotissue? Okay, any questions on the support structures? The blood, the cerebral spinal tissue, the meninges, ventricles. How many ventricles do you have?
Four.
Four, good. And what are the four main arteries supplying the brain? Internal carotid and vertebral, good. Pairs. Okay, great. Starting from the innermost to the outermost, what are the meninge layers? Inner? Pia mater? Arachnoid? Dura mater. Great. Okay. And what forms cerebral spinal fluid? Choroid plexus. Is cerebral spinal fluid stagnant or flowing?
Flowing.
Great. Okay, I think you're ready. So here we go. We're going to hop into the brain, neurotissue. And this is actually one of the hardest parts of the neuro section because it's pure memorization. With membrane physiology, what we did at the end of the day yesterday, that's telling a story. Pretty much you get that down, it stays with you. With this, you have to memorize the structure, the location, and the function. That's all I ask of you. And we're going to keep it simple, all right? We're going to keep it to the need-to-know basis, so don't get mad at me. This is what you need to know. And there's plenty more if you wanted to know. But as you're hearing it, keep it in that frame of reference, location and function. All right? When you study at home, I recommend you take index cards, put, for instance, medulla oblongata on one side, on the other side, the location and the functions of the medulla oblongata, and study that way. It really helps. So we'll start with the brainstem. which means the medulla oblongata, the pons, and the midbrain. Now look at this picture here. I need to get you in the right frame of reference with me. I talked about the hummingbird very, very briefly. I said there's a head to your hummingbird and a beak. Now that's your diencephalon. We're not going to do that just yet. We'll get to that. There's a neck to the bird and a belly. It just had lunch. And then tail feathers. And then it has a wing coming out. You see it? Isn't it cute? Okay. You there with me? You all have... Well, he's missing his wings coming out to the side. And his beak is kind of broken. But anyway, hummingbird. Think hummingbird. I'm going to use that to help you get in the right location. With the brainstem, we're looking at the tail feathers, the belly, and the neck of our hummingbird. So let's go into the brainstem, and we're going to start most inferiorly in the brain with the medulla oblongata. Very fun thing to say. Medulla oblongata. I'll say it all the time. Now, you have to understand that the brain is not like a structure that gets glued onto the spinal cord. They are continuous. It's all made up of neurons and neuroglia, but neurons. And some of these neurons have their cell bodies up here, and the axons travel all the way down your spinal cord. So what you're looking at with the medulla is a continuation of the spinal cord. Some of the neurons also start down low, and the axons come all the way up into the brain. Now, keeping that in mind, all these structures I'm going to talk about have a lot of neurons just passing through. They don't stop there. They don't synapse, but they pass on through. So you're going to hear a lot of what I'm going to say is relay. They relay information. What that means is neurons that have cell bodies below or superior have axons that are passing through that region. So medulla oblongata, the most inferior part of the brain, has a lot of neurons passing through, going down in the spinal cord or coming from the spinal cord up into the rest of the brain. So the first thing I have as far as function is it's a relay. It relays impulses of motor and sensory from the rest of the brain to the spinal cord and vice versa. The other things I have listed are the actual particular functions that the medulla oblongata has a processing job in, meaning it is the thinking center, it is the decision area for those actual functions. So for number two, I have listed a bunch of things that the medulla oblongata does. It's very, very, very important. First of all, it's the center for heart rate control. It increases the heart rate, decreases the heart rate. Very important function to keep you alive. It is the blood pressure center, the respiratory rate center, the area that is controlling swallowing, which is very important. Try not swallowing for a day. Coughing, sneezing, vomiting, and sometimes the most important thing of all, laughing. In this course, you got to have a sense of humor, okay? So laugh, laugh, laugh. All those things are being controlled down here at the most inferior part of the brain. Now, I don't want to get into theology, but I have to come out and just tell you, I am a true believer of evolution. And I'm going to kind of bring that up in my class, and I don't want to offend anyone that doesn't believe in it. Just adjust for your own personal theology. As the brain evolved, it evolved superiorly. So what you're looking at in the inferior part of the brain are your basic life supports that is shared with most animals, most all mammals, and some of the reptiles, birds, and even bugs. Okay? Your basic life support things, respiratory and heart rate, blood pressure, laughing, hyenas, right? They laugh. Okay, so getting back to something I talked about with hydrocephalus, if you have pressure on the brain and your brain starts to try to slip out the foramen magnum, the hole at the base of the skull, you're putting pressure on your basic life support area of the brain. And that's why it's a medical emergency. You'll lose the patient extremely quickly. All right, another function of the medulla oblongata It has 5 cranial nerves that have their cell bodies located there. Cranial nerves, spinal nerves, they make up the peripheral nervous system. How many cranial nerves do you have?
5.
Oh, in the medulla oblongata you have 5, but overall? 12 pairs. Remember, they come out both sides. 12 pairs. So the medulla oblongata has the cell body locations for 5 of those cranial nerves. It is the most inferior part of the brain, so we're talking the last 5 of the 12. And they're all listed there for you. You will eventually have to know all these, okay? But not this actual class. It's tomorrow's class. So same test, different class. So the 5 cranial nerves that come out of the medulla. Okay, moving superiorly, we get to the belly of the brainstem, which is the pons. So this is located superior to the medulla oblongata and inferior to the next structure we're going to learn, which is the midbrain. It also has a lot of relaying, meaning a lot of neurons are going to have their axons traveling through it to connect things. And in particular, the pons has a lot of relaying for the cerebellum. Let's look at the side view of our brain here. Pons is the belly. Sitting just posterior to it is your cerebellum. I'm on the right thing, cerebellum. So the pons is very crucial in communicating anything from the brain and spinal cord to the cerebellum. It all travels through the pons. And in fact, the pons allows the left hemisphere of the cerebellum to communicate to the right hemisphere of the cerebellum. It all goes through the pons. So cerebellum and pons kind of go together. The cerebellum is a big support, a big relay station for anything having to do with the cerebellum. Did I say the pons is the, or did I say this? Yeah, the pons is where all the communication goes through for anything having to do with the cerebellum. All right, so the pons also has one major function. It assists with respiratory rate control along with the medulla oblongata. Now remember, the medulla oblongata had a whole laundry list of things it controls. The pons doesn't really have as much, and it's a bigger structure. It has a lot of coordination with the cerebellum and respiratory rate. There are also some cranial nerves that have their cell bodies located in the pons. And there's 3 of them. So we're just moving our way up. We did the last 5, so starting at 8 to 12 in the medulla oblongata. So now we're moving up to 5, 6, and 7 cranial nerve being in the pons. All right, one more and then we'll take a break, and that's the midbrain. The midbrain is the most superior part of the brain stem. And it's kind of like the forgotten uncle. You know, there's really not a whole lot the midbrain does that is real easy for me to put on a list and say this is its main function, but it is very crucial. Without it, you would be hurting. It does a lot of relaying again, but its relaying, its major function relaying, has to do with motor functions. See, for us to move and do what we do is extremely complex. And if anyone knows anything about robotics, you understand that. Robots don't move like humans do. The smoothness and the coordination. So there's a lot involved to make a good functional movement. And there's several different parts of the brains involved. The cerebrum, the cerebellum, something deep within the cerebrum, which is called the basal ganglia. All those things are involved. And then you need all your special senses, too. You need proprioception. Remember we talked about that? I had you stand on one foot. Okay, you need that, you need your vision coming in, you need your equilibrium from your ears. There's a lot involved in coordinating motion. And all those relays going from one area to the next so they can talk to each other and coordinate go through the midbrain. So the midbrain, if it gets disrupted, patients have a lot of trouble with coordination of movement, with planning of movement, with initiation of movement, sustaining movement, all the different things that go into movement. So think midbrain, think movement, movement relaying. All the information gets relayed. Okay? So that's one big thing. The other big thing that gets relayed with the midbrain is that of vision, reflexes. Now, if I, and I'm not going to do it, but if I like drop this and made a really loud noise, you'd all look. Your eyes would look towards it and then your head would follow. If someone slammed the door real loud, you'd all look. And it's not just out of curiosity, there's a reflex involved. That reflex is coordinated through the midbrain, where vision responds to an auditory stimulus. Okay, and we got tumor cranial nerves in the midbrain. So cranial nerves 3 and 4, which are involved in eye motion, which kind of goes with the last thing I said, with eye reflexes. All right, so that's the midbrain. But they have to stay in the classroom. They live in that shelf there where you see the knee models. That's where they live. So at the end of the day, that's where they'll get put up. But if you want to find them tomorrow when I'm not around, I think I'm around all day tomorrow, just pull them out. All righty, I'm going to turn my mic back on. I'm on. All right, so now we're going to pick up with the cerebellum. We were doing the brainstem, so going most inferior, what's the most inferior structure of the brainstem? Oh, come on, don't you guys like to say that? Let me hear it. Aww. And moving up superiorly, the next structure? The pons. Moving up superiorly, the next structure?
Midbrain.
Great. Now we're going to go into the cerebellum. Yes, the cerebellum is sweet. You have two hemispheres for the cerebellum. They are the light yellow on the model here. Two hemispheres. And they have the convolutions just like the cerebrum has. But notice, they're real tight. Real tight and lined. They're not as zigzaggy or wiggly. Real tight and lined. So there's a different configuration there. But they are kind of similar. In fact, sometimes this is called the little brain, the cerebellum, the little brain. I don't know if the cerebellum likes that or not, but that's what it's sometimes called. Now, if you take a cross-section of it, like I have up on the slide, you'll see the white and the gray matter. Thinking back to yesterday, when you see white matter, what are you supposed to think of? Axons. You can add the myelinated in there because that certainly gives it the color, but you think axons. And the gray matter?
Cell bodies.
So looking at the cerebellum here, where are most of the cell bodies located? Yeah, along the periphery of it, the outside of it. So you have it organized so that you have those cell bodies and dendrites on the periphery, and it's their axons going centrally and going places. Now, where are all these axons that either switch from one hemisphere of the cerebellum to the other or leave the cerebellum to go elsewhere? What structure are they going to go through? The pons. All right. The pons. Remember, the pons and the cerebellum are closely linked. From there, if it's going to coordinate with the other motor structures of the brain, what part of the midbrain would it go through? What part of the midbrain relays a lot of motor activity? It's not the medulla oblongata, so it would be the... I already said the pons. From the pons, it would go to the midbrain. One of the functions of the midbrain is relaying all that motor information from one motor structure of the brain to the other. Your cerebellum is a major motor structure. Major motor structure. It is involved with all the coordination, the subconscious coordination of motor movement. It's also involved with your equilibrium, which means keeping you upright, you know, against gravity, so that you're not always tilted and falling out of your center of gravity. It's involved with equilibrium and with posture. See, right now, I'm not talking about the posture you're sitting in that might be, you know, the way grandma told you to sit. I'm talking about the tone of your muscles that separates you from a rag doll or you from a rigid statue. You all have a little bit of muscle activity going on to kind of hold your muscles, get them in a ready position to contract. And the cerebellum keeps that happening, gives you some tone, some postural tone to your muscles. So the best way to understand the cerebellum is to think about people that are drunk. Because the cerebellum is very, very sensitive to alcohol. And in fact, alcohol causes cerebellar damage. Other things do too, but alcohol is one of the main cerebellar damagers. So if you think of someone who is drunk and how they move, you can understand the cerebellum and what it actually does. So if you haven't seen someone personally drunk, stick around San Antonio. But no, think about a movie where you've seen someone drunk. So let me pull up the whole list of things that go wrong with the cerebellum. And I'm not just talking about drunks here. I'm also talking about other cerebellar disorders. The first one is on your handout. My slide is not following it. But the first one in your handout is ataxia. Ataxia is, again, an A word. So it's a loss of something. And in this case, it's a loss of coordination. Ataxia. So as the movements occur of the extremities, of the trunk, the coordination's not there. Everyone put their arm out to the side, point your finger, and smoothly bring it in and touch your nose looking forward. Okay, I'm not, oh. That shows to me, from what I've seen on the whole here, you all have very smooth, coordinated moments. I'm not seeing any ataxia. Ataxia would be a jerky motion, missing the target. Okay, there's other terms for those specific parts, but ataxia is the general word for a loss of coordination. And if you think of someone who's drunk, they don't have that coordination. They pick up their drink and it starts to slosh all over the place. Okay, the second one, according to your handout, is, I don't know what happened to the slide here, I'm sorry folks, is an inability to walk tandem. Tandem is when you go heel-toe when you walk. Okay, you guys might be catching on, we got the sobriety test here, right? So an inability to walk tandem. Someone that has cerebellar damage cannot coordinate not just the feet to go heel-toe, but they cannot coordinate the equilibrium to keep them with that really small base of support that heel-toe provides, that tandem walk provides. So they sway, they have to step out, they may even fall over because of cerebellar damage. So the cerebellum, that's an example of how the equilibrium and the coordination come together. Following the handout, the next thing talks about hypotonic proximal muscles. Now you may not know what all that means, but you know what proximal means. We're talking your trunk, those things closer to midline. The proximal muscles have low tone. They're ragdoll-like. Ragdoll. And what that does is it causes the muscles more distal to not have the support to work well. When the muscles proximally are hypotonic, are floppy, they don't give the structural support needed for distal movement of the extremity. So you find an incoordination because of that. The next one down is the tremors. I'm not talking about the DTs. I'm talking about cerebellar tremors, which have to do with being able to coordinate to actually hit a target. What's happening is as the limb, foot, arm, any part of the body tries to go towards a target, the agonist and the antagonist start to contract at the same time. Now, agonist and antagonist talk about muscles that are opposites each other. The agonist is the one you want to contract. The antagonist would be then relaxed to allow the antagonist to contract. If they're both contracting at the same time, you get an uncoordinated motion. And what that causes with cerebellar damage patients is at rest they're fine, but as they try to move intentionally to do something, they start to shake. Okay, an example with walking is their foot placement, they start to shake as they're walking. And that would be a cerebellar damage. Now, you really don't see that to that extreme with someone who's drunk, but you do see it with cerebellar damage. And it's called intentional tremors. As they're doing something intentional, that's when the tremors start. Continuing with the handout is dysmetria. Dys is a dysfunction when you hear that. It's not an A. Dysmetria, dysfunction. So what you're having here is a dysfunction in meeting the target. The intentional tremors is part of that. But the other part is the target's here, but they go here. They miss. You know, they're overshooting or they're undershooting. That would be your dysmetria. And you can see that with your drunk people. You see them missing their target. And the last thing on the list is the hardest one to say, dysdiagnodocokinesis. Blah, blah, blah. It's a mouthful. And it's kind of fun because it actually, the actual term talks about being able to do alternating movements, and you have to do that with your tongue just to say the word. So if you take your hands, put your hands palm up, okay, and flip them over, and flip them back, flip them over, flip them back. Okay, you all have a pretty coordinated alternating movement. Let's get more complicated. One palm up, one palm down. Now flip. Okay, can you do that? Yeah, you all look pretty good. This is actually how we test just the head of dokokinesis. We have them do palm movements, and we can do the same thing with the feet, having them tap. That's even more complicated. Even people with good cerebellums can't do that. But we're talking about just the rapidly alternating movements. Can they do it? And someone who has a cerebellar problem cannot. They go very slow. It's just not there. Okay, so that whole laundry list there of impairments tells you what the cerebellum does by showing you what happens when it's broken. And alcohol is one way, just one way of breaking it. All right, so that was about the cerebellum. When you think cerebellum, folks, think coordination. With the midbrain, I was saying that word coordination, but I was really kind of trying to draw on the fact that the midbrain relays the information to all the different major motor spots. The cerebellum is the coordination of motion area. That's what it does. Coordination, the equilibrium, and the posture. Now we're on to the diencephalon, the part that I did my research on. But there's two parts of the diencephalon, the thalamus and the hypothalamus. It's kind of nice that they're named similarly, isn't it? You know they're in the same area. Diencephalon. So now we're at the head and the beak of the little hummingbird. We'll start with the thalamus. The thalamus is a pear-shaped structure. Pear? I meant to say egg. Egg-shaped structure deep inside the brain. You can see one thalamus, but think of it as paired. There's two of them. Now, what it does is it takes all the sensory information and either processes it or relays it up to the cerebrum. But all sensory information goes through the thalamus. Where does sensory information come from? Yeah, peripheral. So either your receptors out in your skin, your receptors in your stomach, your receptors in your heart, all those receptors pick up sensory information, take it to the central nervous system via the, what kind of nerves? A or E? Afferent nerves, take it in, goes up the spinal cord, and all of it has to go through the thalamus. Some of it stays in the thalamus and gets processed there. And the information that happens to is your, let me move the slide up one. Nope, it's not on there. Is the information of pain and temperature. Some of it relays, meaning synapses, or continues on without a synapse and goes to other parts of the cerebrum. So it goes higher within the brain. But all sensory goes through the thalamus. That's the key. You got that? Sensory, thalamus. Thalamus, sensory. Afferent neurons. Put all those together, okay? Sensory. All those together there. And that's all I'm going to say, really, about the thalamus. Then I'll get into the hypothalamus. Now, this is where I did my research, in the hypothalamus. This is more the beaky area of that hummingbird and the area that's inferior and kind of between the thalamus. It's a real nebulous area. It doesn't have a real cut-and-dry boundary to it, the hypothalamus. It's made up of a whole bunch of bundles of cell bodies, and each of those bundles of cell bodies has a function. So the thalamus has a lot of different things that it itself controls. It reminds me a lot of the medulla oblongata. Remember all the things we had there? Respiratory rate, vomiting, hiccuping. Had a lot of things involved in the medulla oblongata, way down low. The hypothalamus has a long laundry list too, but these are not so much your basic survival type functions. I think of these more as the animalistic type functions. So I have them divided out into three sections. The first thing it controls is your autonomic nervous system. That's your sympathetic and your parasympathetic. So autonomic nervous system control happens at the hypothalamus. The flight or fight, remember that? Okay, the second thing it controls are a whole bunch of drives, a whole bunch of conditions that we have. For instance, hunger, sexual behavior, your rhythms, as far as like your sleep and awake rhythms. It controls body temperature. A lot going on there. Your emotions are controlled a lot by the hypothalamus. And the last thing, and I'm going in order of the slide, but not of your handout, so don't get mad. The number two thing on your handout is it controls the endocrine system. Now that's the system that's all about hormones. Probably the first thing you thought of was testosterone and estrogen, but there's a lot more to hormones than the reproductive or the sexual hormones. You got thyroid hormone, adrenaline, you have a lot of hormones, parathyroid, insulin. All that's controlled by the endocrine system. The endocrine system is controlled by the hypothalamus. So three main things: autonomic nervous system, the endocrine system, and then those, I'm going to just call them animal drives and conditions. Okay, now my clinical aspect that I have there. How many of you got teenagers in the house? One, two, nobody else? You want one? I got one free. Teenagers, and some of you are just getting out of this area here. Some of you are still young adults. Teenagers have been shown through doing MRIs that their hypothalamus is much more active than adults. Let's look at that list again. We got it controlling hormones, controlling your autonomic nervous system, controlling hunger, sexual rhythm, and emotions. Okay, this might provide some insight. So before you crack down on your teenagers for being totally stupid, realize that their brains don't work like your brains do. They are utilizing the hypothalamus to make decisions and not what adults use, which is their cerebrum. Okay, which is one step up on the evolutionary chart, if you know what I mean, okay? Your teenagers are working with a different brain. Interesting. All right, moving right along, yes? Yeah, the diencephalon is that part of the brain that's made up of the hypothalamus and the thalamus. And in some lower evolutionary animals, this is as good as it gets. They don't have much cerebrum at all. The diencephalon is really their brain. So, and that's second brain is the other, is how you translate diencephalon. It's the second brain. Yeah. All right. So any questions on the diencephalon? Yes. It's very deep within the brain, so as far as traumatic injury, there's not a lot. And interesting, there's not a lot of pathologies that are involved with the diencephalon. So I'd say very injury resistant. Now, there are some genetical or malformations involved with the hypothalamus, which can give a lot of insight on behavior. So when you look at neuropsychiatry, the hypothalamus has a lot to do with different behavioral conditions. One of them being your psychopaths. And there's a lot of research on that now that they have the techniques to do a lot of research for those folks that are just evil, you know, that don't seem to have any emotion, any compassion, any empathy. They're looking at the hypothalamus as the root of the problem there and what exactly is going on with the physiology that's producing this. So... You're. I'm so glad you're thinking that because I wanted to bring that up. That when TBI is the biggest problem we have coming out of the Middle East with our soldiers, And it's not the most reported, but it is the biggest problem. And looking at the symptoms, it is the control centers of the hypothalamus. Now, what's happening with the TBI, traumatic brain injury, is you have some sort of shock, some sort of damage to the brain because of an insult. And typically, with our military folks, it's because of a blast injury. So things are being shaken up, compressed, moved. And where is the insult really occurring within the brain? So they're doing a lot of research on that to get some basic science as far as what's being damaged. And beyond that, the therapy people are doing research to find out how to treat. But as we were talking during break, therapy is really highlighting the symptom of dizziness. And that's where our research is looking. So that's what I'm most familiar with, but I know there's tons of research being done in the military on TBI. So over the next couple of years, the results should be coming out. But that is a good point. That's one area they're really targeting to see what's happening with the hypothalamus, with the TBI. Being so internal and so well insulated, you wouldn't think that would be where the injury occurs, but the symptoms sure look like it. Yeah, very interesting. I'm so glad you brought that up. And we'll have, stick around 4 months, we'll have a class on TBI then. And hopefully it will be different from the class we had just a couple weeks ago with the senior class, because I'm hoping some research is starting to come out. All right, now we're into the last part of the brain, and I have like 10 minutes. Wow. The cerebrum, don't worry. If we go over in this class, we have plenty of fudge room with the next one. The cerebrum, the most superior part of the brain, and very complex. Very, very complex. We're going to talk first about the geography of the cerebrum, so just some basic anatomy, and then we'll get into functions. First of all, basic anatomy. The outer portion of the cerebrum is called the cerebral cortex. So you'll hear that. You have the cerebrum. The outermost portion is your cortex. And that is composed of gray matter. Let me see if I have a cross-section. I do. So looking at a cross-section of the cerebrum, you see the same sort of organization that you saw when you saw the cross-section of the cerebellum. The periphery, which we now call the cortex, the cerebral cortex is made up of the gray matter. Deeper inside, you see white matter. And then if you look really deep, you'll see gray matter again. But the cortex part is definitely gray. I see some question marks. Let me highlight over here. So looking at the picture that is a cross-section, I'll color in red the cortex. That's gray. So if you follow that along, it's gray. And I believe you have this in your handout too, don't you, at some point? It's a couple more pages back. I have it on 14, but I think your pages and mine are a little bit different. But you have the gray matter. Below that gray matter, so going deeper into the cerebrum, I'll do in blue, you have white matter. Here you have a lot of white matter. Here you have a lot of white matter. And we're going to name those white matters. But then, here, you have some gray matter again. So deep, deep within the cerebrum is gray matter. This part here is diencephalon. I'll put the big D there. And then we have brainstem down here. So cerebrum is really... Let me draw this little triangle here, or whatever, the square. Cerebrum is everything not colored blue. I have to cross out a lot. We have a lot of cerebrum. So gray matter on the cortex, then some white matter, and then deep inside we have gray matter again. That's called the basal ganglia. When we talk about that, you know there's only like 2 more minutes left in class. Okay? You know, no break time is there. All right, so getting back to the cerebral cortex, the gray matter. We're looking at cell bodies, not axons, cell bodies. The surface geography here, you have the ridges, which is a gyrus, plural gyri. It always drives me nuts. It's like cactus and cacti, right? Gyrus, gyri. Then you have the grooves, which are sulcus, sulci, plural, grooves. And we're going to name a couple sulci because they're important. And in fact, every groove and every sulci has a name. We're just going to pull out the real key ones for us to know so we can help each other find things, all right, by knowing the key names. And then between the two hemispheres, you have an extremely deep groove. That's a fissure. All right, so sulci, grooves, really deep groove, fissure. The important sulc eyes to know are the lateral sulcus, which, believe it or not, lies laterally. So looking at the hemisphere laterally, the lateral sulcus goes right here behind your ear. Lateral sulcus. It separates some of the lobes of the cerebrum, so that's why it's a key one. But it's also a really obvious sulcus compared to the others. It's a pretty deep one, but not a fissure. It's a sulcus, your lateral sulcus, running here. You can also use the lateral sulcus to figure out which side of the cerebrum is anterior and which is posterior, because the sulcus opens up anteriorly. So if you're ever looking at that picture that you have there, the different colored ones, and you're trying to figure out what's anterior, what's posterior, look for that lateral sulcus. It comes out anteriorly. And then you'll know that this is the frontal lobe. All right, so if you ever get mixed up in that picture, look for the lateral sulcus. The central sulcus is the one that separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe, and I think of it as the hairband sulcus. On this one here, the central sulcus is easy to tell because it separates the red from the blue. Okay, because it's a colored brain. On your picture there, you can find the central sulcus. It separates the red from the yellow. That would be your central sulcus. Where it lies is where a hairband would lie. Girls know what these do. You know, they hold back the hair. So guys, if you had long hair, you might want to wear one. I've actually saw somebody wearing one playing in the NBA. But anyway, that would be your central sulcus. I skipped the fissure, so let me go back. The fissure is called the longitudinal fissure, and that's the one that lies between the two hemispheres, separates left from right hemisphere, longitudinal fissure. We have one more sulcus we're going to name, and that's the parieto-occipital sulcus. This separates the parietal lobe from the occipital lobe. And one nice thing about these lobes are the same as the bones you learned, all right, of the cranium. So you did have to learn that with osteology, right? The different cranium bones? No? Oh, okay. Well, anyway, if you did learn the bones, they would be the same name, so you wouldn't have to learn the names again. But since you didn't, you will learn the names of the lobes. The bones that lie over them of the cranium have the same name. But anyway, going back to the sulcus, the parieto-occipital sulcus lies between the occipital lobe and the parietal lobe, which is in the posterior part of the brain. So on your diagram there, the occipital lobe is kind of like a blue color, which is hard to differentiate it from the temporal lobe. But anyway, it's between the yellow and the blue towards the back, towards the posterior part of the brain. So those are some of the geography things: gyrus, sulcus, fissure, and then the four specifics: the longitudinal fissure, lateral sulcus, central sulcus, parieto-occipital sulcus. And that will help us find things as we go through the rest of the class. Here's a diagram that you have in your handout that shows the longitudinal fissure straight down the middle. So going just like that. It also shows the central sulcus. I'll do it in red. It's going like that. Now, if you don't have a brain that's colored or that has dots and other things on it, how do you find the central sulcus? It is the sulcus that goes from longitudinal fissure all the way down to lateral sulcus, undisruptive. All the other ones kind of double back. You know, it's like those mazes where you get to a dead end. All the other sulci pretty much do dead ends. But the central sulcus goes all the way from longitudinal fissure down to lateral. So when I bring up the cadaver brains, you can see if you can find it. It's not as easy as I make it sound, but it is there. All right, white matter. You already know that that's your axons, but let's name a couple of those main axon thoroughfares, the main highways of the brain. And then deep down, we have one more area of gray matter, the basal ganglia. We'll get to that in time. So the first main highway of white matter is this one here. It's a bridge between the left and the right hemisphere. It is the corpus callosum. And you know what kind of neurons are in there because you know which neurons go from one hemisphere to the other. What are they? Common serial neurons. It's right here on the slide for you. Common serial neurons. What are the ones that go from a gyrus to a gyrus within a hemisphere? Association. I'm so glad to hear some people are studying, because it's a lot to take in. So it's good that every night you take in as much as you can. All right, so common sural neurons go from one hemisphere to another, and they use the corpus callosum. Some interesting stuff out there is looking at the disorder someone has who has a cut of the corpus callosum. And if I have time later on, I'll read you a description of these patients. They are very bizarre. All right, another main highway is called the internal capsule. This one takes axons in and out of the cerebrum with medial to the internal capsule. You have your thalamus. Well, let's not get into that. Let's just do internal capsule for right now. We have the internal capsule there. Medial. I do have it. You have your basal ganglia and the thalamus on either side bracketing it. So you'll see gray matter on either side of it. But the internal capsule is that white matter, the axons leaving the cerebrum, going to the spinal cord, or vice versa. Spinal cord going up to the cerebrum. So what kind of information, motor or sensory, would be coming from cerebrum going down into the spinal cord? Motor. Sensory will be going up. All right, keep that in mind for the next class. Okay, hemispheres. Back in the 80s, there was a lot of science on the two hemispheres of the brain. And a big question people would ask is, are you right-brained or left-brained? Well, it's still kind of out there. It's not as much of a fad as it was back then, but there's some truth to it all. The two hemispheres of the brain, although symmetrical, do not function the exact same way. One hemisphere tends to be more of your logical type thought processes, and the other your more artistic, creative thought processes. And interestingly, it's not until midlife that you use both hemispheres simultaneously. So all you 20-year-olds, you're pretty much trying to use one or the other instead of using them both together. Us wise 30 and older year olds, we're using them at the same time, which is why we're so wise. Because we're able to be logistical or logical as well as creative all at once. See, there's some good things to aging. Good things. So looking at this laundry list, it gives you some of the characteristics of a left brain function versus the right brain function, and I'm talking hemispheres here. And you can see which one you tend to be more dominant in. And that's the whole idea of the fad. It's which brain, which hemisphere dominates you. Well, folks, you're using both, especially once you're 30 and older. But there is a tendency to be more one than the other. So are you more the logical, linear thinking person? You like to have things all planned out in a plan, very analytical. You can use abstract signals. You're very language-oriented, so you learn well by someone speaking to you. Maybe this is my oldest brother. He's a nuclear physicist, engineer. He drives submarines. Not anymore. He's retired, but he was a submarine XO before he retired. Someone who thinks very, very logical. Someone that can actually take a motor of a car and build it. Then you have the right brain person, or the right hemisphere, which is more synthetic thinking, meaning taking everything and kind of pulling it together. More abstract, more creative, using more mental imagery, not so much just language, using more the visual and mental imagery, more space perception, and emotional. And I'm not talking about emotional like the hypothalamus, where it's, you know, anger and rage and love and all that. I'm talking about more that they're able to think more emotionally, use that in their thought process. Anyway, you decide where you are, if you're more the one side or the other as far as being dominant. And again, you don't have to be. Some people draw on both. There's some other things with the left and the right brain that are more appealing to me than that. And that is that folks that have damages on the left or the right brain do display differently. So you take someone who has a CVA of the left brain versus the right brain, and you get two totally different personalities based on those laundry lists I showed you. I mean, so there is that basis there, and that's what's more important to me, not which one's more dominant in the functional person, but in someone who's had a brain injury, what do they present with more commonly? So personally, I prefer someone who's had a right hemisphere brain injury because they seem to be a little bit more bizarre, a little bit more challenging because of the personality disorders that come along with them, lack of judgment, and some of the really bizarre clinical things, which hopefully I'll give you a taste of in the rest of these classes. Versus someone who has a left brain injury, they tend to be more scared, more intimidated, more fearful because they seem to understand what's going on more, and they tend to have more language problems because your language centers in 80% of the population are on the left side of the brain, the left hemisphere. So that's where clinically this comes in, and when you stick around for that class 4 months from now, we'll get into those patients and how to treat them. All right, so we have two hemispheres. We've got gyri sulci, the main fissure down there. But what about the lobes? Let's look at those four different lobes, identify their functions. So now we're going back to name, location, and function, and then we'll be done with the brain class. So stick with me, folks, okay? I'm a little bit late on the break, but we'll get there. All right, highly, highly organized these lobes are. Highly organized. You can take a probe and a map of the brain and take that probe and touch and get what you expect. You can get a response that you would expect. We are all pretty much organized the same way. Even though we're different people, different personalities, our brains are organized very, very similarly. So the first lobe we're going to look at is the frontal lobe. A lot goes on in the frontal lobe, but I'm going to highlight two main things: personality and motor. With motor, the frontal lobe is your key area for all voluntary motor. Remember, the cerebellum was involved with motor too, but that was more subconscious coordination, equilibrium, posture. Frontal lobe, that's the part of your brain that really decides what movements are going to get done and how. It's the planning and the actual doing of the motor. There's an area called the precentral gyrus. And on this color-coded brain, it's in red, the precentral gyrus. And let me pull up the other hemisphere. This one, which is also in red, has striations on it, has stripes. Each one of these stripes identifies a different part of the body. If I take a probe with electrical current on it and zap right here on that precentral gyrus, I will cause motor activity in the hip. So hip muscles will actually start to contract, depending on where that probe is right there. If I move it a little bit farther down the side here, let's say I go midway down and touch right here with a probe, I'll cause finger movement. The muscles of the finger will contract. Very, very organized, very exact. This precentral gyrus, remember this gyrus, highlight, highlight, this gyrus is the main primary control of all voluntary motor activity. So if you want a muscle to contract, skeletal muscle, there has to be a signal from the precentral gyrus telling that muscle to contract. That's where it comes from. And people have actually done this. They've actually played with brains. Usually it's like experimenters. They, you know, do their own brain. They have someone do it. Actually, one did his own brain. And they take probes and they can make certain things move according to where they put the probe, where they zap it. Okay, so that's where you get the primary message, muscle move. Axon travels down, eventually you have the muscle synapse onto the muscle and the muscle contracts. But it takes a whole lot more than just the command saying muscle move. It has to be planned out. Usually you don't have one muscle moving all by itself and just one contraction. It's a coordination of contractions of several muscles over a period of time. That planning occurs more anterior in the frontal lobe, called the prefrontal premotor area. The premotor area plans the movement out. It learns the movement. How many could do a layup the first time they tried? I'm a basketball fan. No, it takes time. You have to learn the coordination of it. Part of that happens in the cerebellum with the coordination of the movements. Part of it happens in the premotor with the planning, the sequencing of those motions. So a lot of learning happens in the premotor area. Signal then goes to the precentral gyrus, tells muscles to contract in the way they're supposed to, and they do. Frontal lobe, motor. All right? Moving away from motor. Oh, and if you have an injury there, you're going to lose motor of that area. So if you have an injury in the frontal lobe, expect to have some motor problems. Going to the other main function of the frontal lobe, we get to personality. Oh, before I get to personality, look at this slide. This is called the Penfield homunculus. Homunculus is a term for little man. And you have a little man laying on that precentral gyrus. You can actually map it out, and what Penfield did in mapping it out, he also had the drawing on there too, so it kind of shows you everything. Okay, there's one of these for sensory and one for motor, and I believe this one is the motor one. So it's all mapped out here. You have this in your handout, so I wanted you to know what it's all about. It's the precentral gyrus. It shows that mapping. Now getting to personality. The very front of the frontal lobe, called the frontal pol, is where you have the personality. So if you have someone who has an injury to the very front of their frontal lobe, you're going to have some bizarre personality disturbances. I had a friend who, her husband had a brain tumor in the frontal lobe. Interestingly, he's a very knowledgeable physician. He was like, oh, interesting. I got a tumor in the front of my brain, and it's going to kill me in 6 months. So, how are you doing today? His personality was affected by that brain tumor to the point where he had no understanding of the consequences of his brain tumor, which was very frustrating to the family because they're all planning his, you know, funeral and life after and, you know, saying goodbye, and he's totally oblivious to the whole thing. You know, like, hey, let's go out to, you know, let's go to the food market today. They're like, you know. So frontal lobe, personality, you get some really interesting changes in a person when they have any sort of impairment there. All right, one more thing about the frontal lobe. Talked about motor. Part of motor is language. Now, there's the actual speech production of language, which really involves motor, making your tongue, your lips, and all that move. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about being able to take your thoughts and process them into language so you can communicate. Now, some of you may have thoughts and may want to communicate, but if you get with someone who only speaks, what language does no one speak in here? Japanese. Okay, so if you're trying to communicate with someone who speaks just Japanese, you have your thoughts, your mouth works, but you can't communicate to them. You can't get your thoughts into their language. Imagine not being able to get your thoughts into your native tongue. That's an aphasia, a communication disorder, and that's what happens when you have an injury to Broca's area. Broca's area is this dark blue area here in the frontal lobe. It's near the areas that actually control the muscles of speech production. But what it does is it takes thoughts and puts it into language. And when you have an injury there, you have a patient who cannot communicate what they want to communicate because they can't get it into language. Very frustrating.
Does that mean that they can process it enough to write it out?
Sometimes they have trouble putting it into writing too. It depends on where, how widespread the injury is. So sometimes they can't communicate at all with you. Sometimes they still have the ability to write. Very frustrating. We'll have more on that towards the end of the class. The parietal lobe is the next lobe posterior. So frontal lobe, we're in front of the central sulcus, the headband sulcus. Now we're going to go behind the headband sulcus into the parietal lobe. It's above the ear, so we're above the lateral sulcus. So on my slide, it's white. On your little picture, what color is it? Is it yellow?
Yellow.
Okay. And that's the picture you'll see on the test, the little picture with the colors. Okay, you'll see that if I'm asking you to locate a lobe. The parietal lobe is pretty interesting, but we're just going to stick to the basics because otherwise there's no way for me to ever finish this class. And the basics are that the parietal lobe is all about sensory. Frontal lobe is motor and personality. Parietal lobe is sensory. So this is where all the processing occurs to take those sensations that have been gathered from your internal and external environment and put them into sense. It's really an amazing feat if you think about it, because you are being bombarded with thousands of sensations, but yet you're able to focus on me for the most part. Okay? That's a really incredible feat. How many of you drive and actually really focus on your driving? You know, you've gotten somewhere and you went, oh my gosh, I don't remember going through that, you know, stoplight. How did I? Okay? We're able to pull in a lot of sensations and respond to them without actually focusing on them. Parietal lobe, it's an amazing structure. All right, so primary sensory, just like we had the pre-central gyrus, which means it's in front of, it's pre the central sulcus, we have a post-central gyrus. Now, a lot of students have trouble with that. They get the two confused. Post has an S in it. Pre does not. Post is referring to sensory. So that may help you. It helps me. All right. Post-central gyrus, parietal lobe, that's your primary sensory strip, meaning all sensations are organized according to the body right there, and they all go through there. Then they'll go to the rest of the parietal lobe for further analysis and decide what to actually focus on and what not to. The post-central gyrus. And on this hemisphere, it's striated and labeled as to what goes to what, just like that homunculus that we saw. Now, both of these areas, the parietal lobe and the frontal lobe, one's motor, one's sensory, both of them control the opposite side of the body. We'll find that out when we do the spinal cord class and we actually watch a neuron go from one to the other, from one extreme to the other. We'll see that they cross over at some point. So the frontal lobe on the right side controls motor of the left side. The parietal lobe of the right side pulls sensation from the left side of the body. Everything crosses from the brain. So if you have a patient that has a right side brain injury, they're going to have weakness on their left side of their body if it's in the frontal lobe. If it's in the parietal lobe, they're going to have sensation troubles coming from the left side of their body. Kind of bizarre, huh? Everything crosses. Before I move on, one more thing, talking about language. This was a question that was asked with Broca's area, talking about that aphasia, not being able to communicate, not being able to express yourself. It's called Broca's aphasia and expressive aphasia. There's other types of aphasia. The angular gyrus is in the parietal lobe, and it is back towards the back end here, and that's involved with recognition of the written word. So within language, the written and the spoken are analyzed in different parts of the brain, but they're real close to each other. The angular gyrus is the portion of the parietal lobe that recognizes symbols, written word, and can actually put it into communication. So for me, it would be like looking at Japanese on paper, right? You know. It doesn't make any sense. But imagine me now looking at my own language on paper and it not making sense. That would be a disorder of the angular gyrus. And that is called visual aphasia if you have that disorder. All right, we're almost there. Temporal lobe. Now we're behind the ears, so we're inferior to that lateral sulcus. The temporal lobe is involved in auditory perception. Isn't that nice? It's right behind the ear. It's an easy thing, okay? Rejoice, rejoice. I'm not going to get into it much more, but there are other things that this lobe does. And it's just because of time constraints, we can't go further. But I do have to tell you, this is where memory occurs. It's not in your handout, but memory in the temporal lobe. All right, moving right along. The thing that you do need to know for your patient's sake is an area called Wernicke's area. And where are you on here? Okay, Wernicke's area is this red spot right here on the temporal lobe. It's where the temporal lobe meets the parietal lobe. This is your lateral sulcus, so it's dividing the two. It's right there. Wernicke's area is the other half of communication that I haven't talked about. That's the half of communication of pulling in information and making sense of it. If you, that area takes what is heard, what is seen, well, we're just going to go with what is heard. What is heard takes that and interprets it into thoughts. So if you've ever been in a situation and you say, when did you come over to America? 2004. Okay, he knows what I'm talking about here. Where you come into a situation where everyone's speaking a language that's not your native tongue. And they're speaking it real quick, aren't they? Really quick. You're hearing it. Your ears are working. But you're not able to process it. That's what Wernicke's area does. It processes it. If you have a disorder of it, it's like hearing people from another language talk. Only it's your own language. And you're not able to understand what they're saying. You think they're talking gibberish. You can pick up maybe a few things, but not all of it. And that would be called Wernicke's aphasia or receptive aphasia, not being able to take in. Our CVA patients very commonly have one of these aphasias. That's why we're highlighting these communication areas. Wernicke's area. And the last lobe of the cerebrum is the occipital lobe. Lies in the inferior portion of the brain, posterior inferior. And this is the area for visual recognition and perception. Occipital eye vision. It doesn't just process the information, it helps integrate eye movements. If something moves, the eyes will go for it. They'll look for it. You always hear that, like if you're out in the woods and, you know, there's a big cat watching you. The reason he probably observed you is smell or movement. They pick up the movement and they track on it. The occipital lobe is what does that. So it processes all the information, but it also fixes the eyes on different objects. Now, if you have a problem with the occipital lobe, you will be blind. But that doesn't mean your eyes don't work. Kind of weird, huh? It's called neurological blindness. It's just a very bizarre thing, and you might see someone who has a CVA of the occipital lobe, very rare, but you never know, and they'll be considered blind, even though the eyes work fine. All righty. Last thing. I'm not going to do the lobe review. We're just going to go straight to the basal ganglia here. These are the deep gray structures located within the cerebrum. Very deep structures in there. The basal ganglia is actually made up of three pairs of nuclei. And what I mean by nuclei, cell bodies. Bundles of cell bodies. Now, those three are the caudate nucleus, the putamen, and the globus pallidus, but I don't want you to have to memorize that. Just know basal ganglia. The function of the basal ganglia is to initiate and control voluntary movement. We had the frontal lobe involved with movement, we had the cerebellum involved with movement, and now the basal ganglia, but they each have their individual functions. The basal ganglia is all about control and initiation of that motion, getting it going. The best way I can describe that is to think of someone who has a disorder of the basal ganglia, and that would be somebody with either Parkinson's disease or Huntington's disease. You may have heard of it as Huntington's chorea. Those diseases affect the basal ganglia. With Parkinson's, you get someone who's rigid, very mask-like. They don't have a lot of initiation of movement, so they look statuesque almost. When they walk, it's a rigid movement. You don't see arm swing. You see little movements of the legs as they walk. I'm trying to stay on the podium as they walk. Their feet are shuffling. You don't see the dorsiflexion and toe off that you do in normal gait. It's a shuffling type walk. A little bit of motion. a lot of times they get stuck, called akinesia, where they can't move. Initiation of movement is lost. So that's the basal ganglia being a problem there. They tend to lose their center of gravity because they're so bent over. They're out of their base of support, and they do tend. Yeah, they are a big fall risk. And the other thing about it, they don't initiate movements real quick. So if they're falling, you and I would put a hand out. A lot of times they don't initiate that, and they'll fall and break a hip or their face or something. Typically, they'll have a walker. Canes are too tricky for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they get to that stage, they'll go to walk a cane first, but usually when you see someone that dysfunctional with Parkinson's, they're in a walker. And it's one with wheels because they cannot even initiate the pickup, so they just kind of go like this. We'll have fun when we get into the later classes talking about all these disorders because they are extremely interesting.